But the flip side is with organic, we know that it's possible to, right? For these farmers who've been doing tillage with intention of feeding the soil for decades, right? Like you said, the science backs that up. They're increasing their soil organic matter. They're increasing the whole ecosystem,
Yeah.
not just the soil, the whole ecosystem around the farm. Right. So this idea that tillage is the one practice that's the worst practice you could do. I mean, let's think about where that came from for a second. Like, to attach the word regenerative now to the one thing an organic farmer will never walk away from. I mean, is that coincidence? I don't know, but it's striking, isn't it? That's now the one thing people are so focused on.
Welcome to the Real Organic Podcast. I'm Dave Chapman, co-director of the Real Organic Project. Real Organic is a grassroots farmer-led movement trying to reconnect with the roots of organic. Today's podcast is an interview done by my co-director, Lindley Dixon, with Charlotte Vallès. Charlotte is a researcher doing PhD work on the growth and development of the regenerative agriculture movement and its relationship to the organic movement. Charlotte was a strong voice in our 2023 Real Organic Symposium, and tickets are still available to that if you would like. Just go to realorganicsymposium.org. Okay, here we go.
Welcome to the Real Organic Podcast. I'm sitting here with Charlotte Vallès, and where are we? Outside Cambridge in this beautiful pastoral setting. This is your home?
Yep, this is Harvard, Massachusetts.
Okay, thank you so much for inviting us here to your home, and we're just going to have a conversation this really beautiful evening. We've got sheep and chickens and dogs running around. Just tell us, I mean, we met first I was working for Cornucopia, and you were had worked for Cornucopia, and so we were both kind of showing up at these National Organic Standards Board meetings, working on organic integrity. They're a little insane. Let people kind of know how we met and the environment that we met under, because it's unique, you know?
It is,
A weird world.
Yes, it's a small world. It's kind of a close-knit community, the organic community. And we met. I had just left Cornucopia, gone to Consumers Union to work on organic integrity, and you had taken my job.
That's
after
right.
I left. We met really, I think, fighting for organic integrity in the nonprofit world, and you for Cornucopia, and I was working for Consumers Union.
How did you get interested in organic agriculture in the beginning?
So let's go way back, I guess, to my childhood. I've always been an environmentalist, just as a kid, one of those kids that gets deeply saddened when they see injustice and, you know, beg my brother to stop catching insects in the backyard and hurting them, you know, that kind of...
Putting him in a jar and torturing them.
Putting him in a jar, exactly. So I've just always had that in me, and then moved to the U.S. when I was 12. So that's where...
From
Belgium.
Okay.
Yeah, grew up in Belgium. Moved to the U.S. when I was 12 and experienced culture shock like any 12-year-old would or any person would. And for me, it was really all about food. I was really...
Even when you were 12?
Yes. I was struck by not so much what people... ate or eat in the U.S., but how? Just the culture around food.
Well, describe that. What do you mean by that?
So I remember the first time being at somebody's house, and it was lunchtime, and I just expected people, the family was home, and it was lunchtime, and I expected them to say, okay, let's go sit around the table and eat lunch. And my new friend opened the fridge and said, take anything you want. And we ate it standing up and
with the fridge doors open.
First time I saw, fries are from Belgium. They call them French fries here, but they're actually Belgian. And you eat them on Sunday, and it's kind of a special part of a special meal on Sunday. And first time I saw somebody eating fries in a car, while driving, I was just shocked.
Probably prepared a little bit differently, right? Not so processed.
Exactly. So then as I got older and started learning more about, it's not just how people eat around mealtime, but just the whole culture around food and how it's prepared and how it's grown. I remember as a kid going to a farm to pick up milk directly from the farmer.
Oh, wow.
And so just really got interested in kind of food and the environment. Didn't really think I would end up in organic agriculture until graduate school.
When did it start to click about how the food was produced, not just how you eat it and the culture around eating it?
Yeah, so that actually happened in Africa, where I was really into social justice. I studied theology and philosophy in college, and ended up thinking I would work in like international development. So spent a year in Africa working on something completely non-food related.
Where in Africa were you?
In Burkina Faso.
Okay.
Yep. And one day we're riding through the countryside on our moped, and we stop in a village, and a farmer stops us and has this bottle, and he needs help translating. And it was a bottle of insecticide. And I just remember seeing the skull and crossbones after already being aware that in the countryside, it was all cotton grown for export. Mm-hmm. And the farmer needed help really translating the dilution instructions. Mm. And that's where it kind of clicked for me, this pivotal moment where I realized, we're kind of exporting this industrial mindset, this mechanistic way of thinking, which is what I'd been studying in agriculture. And we're exporting that to Africa. And the problem is really coming from where I'm from, right? So I felt the need to kind of, if I wanted to do something good and work on these issues, I realized I should go home, because that's where it's originating, and it's that mindset, that industrialized mindset being applied to agriculture, doing a lot of harm. Also just that, they weren't growing food. They weren't even using that industrial mindset to grow food. It was growing, using their farmland for cotton, for export,
right,
not to feed the local population. So the environmentalism and social justice and applying that to agriculture and food kind of, that's where it clicked for me.
So you explained to someone who had no safety equipment was a poison. And
he knew it was a poison because of the skull and crossbones. That's all he knew.
Yeah.
And he couldn't read the instructions. He had been diluting it wrong. And he'd just been given it by the company that he was supposed to grow the cotton for. And
when I traveled a bunch, too, I noticed that there were I was an extension agent on Guam. And there were instances where, I think the government was purchasing it and giving it out for free.
Yeah.
So farmers there were very small, and they didn't have any protection either.
Right.
And they were saying, this was given to us. Yeah. And it'll make us better farmers. And so they were just told to spray it without any of the safety stuff. But it's not like the chemical companies are handing it out. They're actually getting paid by the governments from tax dollars then to see if, and I could see why they might hand it out too and say, let's see if we can convert these new markets for our chemicals. But to me, that was even worse, that it was like our tax dollars or the people's tax dollars were going, and then the chemical companies were getting paid to hand this stuff out. That's so,
and all done in the name of progress, right? That's the other thing that kind of struck me, is this is supposedly in their own best interest. That's the story we're told, is whenever I'd ask questions, but are they growing food for themselves? Because there's a lot of just malnourished children, and it was like, no, but they get money which they can then use to buy, it was all done in the name of progress. And
so what did you witness, and you said you saw some malnutrition. Like, did you see that there were the conversion of farmland away from producing food for people? And
yeah, I mean, the men were working to grow cotton, and then the women were kind of, you know, trying to keep these smaller plots that where they were growing, trying to grow food for their families, but still. Yeah, definitely saw malnutrition and children especially.
So how did that translate into what you wanted to study when you came back?
So I just got, you know, more interested in just the system being messed up, and you know, kind of the global food system. And had studied, like I said, I studied religious studies and philosophy, so decided to apply for a Master of Theological Studies to study the mindset behind that, because that's what I was really interested in. And
explain, like, kind of what you learned.
So, you know, it's kind of, it goes back to how we view the world, right? That's what theology is how do we see reality? What's our understanding as humans of where we fit in this large, you know, in the world, essentially. What's humanity's place in it? And also, how do we view reality? What's our understanding of how the world works? And in African religions, it's very different, right? In Western societies, it comes out of the kind of the Enlightenment, the Cartesian mindset of we can pick things apart. The earth is essentially one big system that is almost like a machine, and you can pick pieces, elements out of it and study it in isolation, which is not reflective of reality. That's not how the world works. And so when you apply that to agriculture, and you kind of see humans as able to control those processes, and you see them more as mechanistic relationships rather than large ecological mysterious in the sense that we humans didn't create it, and so we can use science to try to get greater understanding of it, but we're never going to fully understand it, right? So when you apply that to agriculture, you see the farm as a factory, which is really how in conventional chemical-based agriculture, industrialized agriculture views the farm. It's a bunch of inputs. You can, right, use synthetic fertilizers and pesticides, and you find water. If it doesn't come out of the sky, you irrigate, right? And you use industrial tools for tillage, and you combine that, and you get your outputs. I mean, it's a total factory. And in animal agriculture, same thing, right? You don't use the ecological processes that are out there in the world, which is the alternative rate, right? Like, true organic farming is all about managing these very powerful ecological processes and kind of harnessing them and directing them towards food production. But you're never going to think that you, as a human, can ever overcome or control or overpower natural ecological processes. You're working with them. So that's kind of where it all started for me. And then I met Frederick Kirschman. He was a guest speaker. And when I heard him give his guest lecture, I was just like, oh, wow, this is great. And ended up having dinner with him. I was invited to have dinner with him and the professor who taught the course at the School of Public Health. And
where was this?
At Harvard.
Okay.
Yep.
He was like just a guest that
yep.
came
so,
to speak?
Okay. Yep. The course was called, I mean, this was a long time ago when people were starting to really become concerned about climate change. So it was called, the course was at the School of Public Health. It was on human health and global environmental change.
Okay.
And so Frederick Kirschman was a guest speaker, and the professor, who'd been like a Nobel Prize winner, and I ended up having dinner together, and it was great. And I don't think I said a word. I just listened to these two geniuses talk to each other about agriculture. This professor ended up actually living out here. He also has an orchard, And that's, yeah, that's where I was like, I want to keep studying the science and the policy behind it.
What you're describing is so organic. I'm curious if you thought that the law captured the essence of farming within the way nature works. Do you feel like the law did that for organic?
Well, I think the law did as good a job as any law can do. And I think the regulations...
describing something as complex as...
Exactly.
As an ecosystem, you know, and farming within that. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, and this is what the regenerative movement is going through today, right? Because a lot of people in regenerative, or who advocate for regenerative agriculture, that's what they're trying to do. They're saying it's complex. It cannot be defined. It cannot be standardized. And they're kind of resisting that, but I think they're starting to see, oh, but if you don't have any kind of standard, any kind of definition, then look what happens, right? Then anybody can claim the word, and anybody can claim that they're doing, you know, in this case, regenerative agriculture. And it gets, you know, it's the race to the bottom, right? Like, how low can you go and still call it, still attach that word to it? And with organic, that's what the law and the regulations do, is they say, at least, like, no, you cannot use these inputs. And it's not perfect, and it's never going to capture the true essence and the, you know, this concept fully. But at least having a standard and having a law and regulations, I think, is incredibly valuable. And imagine what it would be if we didn't have that, right?
Sometimes I look back at the Organic Foods Production Act language and I think, I don't know how I could write a regenerative standard any better.
Right.
That language is so good.
I know.
Where did it go wrong? Like, what, if the language is so good, if the law is there, what's, you know,
enforcement?
What did we find out, you know, when we were in those National Organic Standards Board meetings together?
I think it's enforcement and it's pressure. We're in the system, right? Where we live in a capitalist society, and there's a lot of forces working against us. I just wish there were better enforcement of the regulations. The other thing is, you know, I think a lot about the consumer piece. I worked for Consumers Union for 7 years, and now at General Mills, it's, you know, most consumers don't understand that organic isn't just about your own personal exposure to pesticides and avoiding that. They don't understand that there's this whole section, multiple sections actually, on soil health, that really, if you know, like you said, if you're trying to write a regenerative standard, then organic is pretty good, right?
Yeah.
It covers biodiversity, water quality, soil, all these things that people are talking about today as regenerative are already in federal law and have been for 20 years. And it's just, you know, we maybe haven't done a good job of making that holistic picture known to consumers. And, you know, and I think that's in part because consumers want to know, well, what's in it for me? Why should I pay more for this? And so how you're going to get consumers to pay more is by focusing on the benefit to them from reducing pesticide exposure. But now that there's more awareness of food and the connection to planets and the planetary health crises we're facing, I think we need to do a better job of making sure people know that, if they're looking for something in a grocery store where they don't have that direct connection with the farmer, then organic is the label to look for. And then for the consumers who are really, you know, the core organic consumers, for them, then it's the add-on labels. Then if you want to go even deeper and get even more regenerative, then look for Real Organic Project, Regenerative Organic Certified. But for the majority of consumers, we still have a lot of Americans who don't even know what organic means.
What would you tell them if you heard, you know, it's just the absence of harmful pesticides and synthetic fertilizers? What would you say it goes beyond?
Well, now there's so much focus on soil health. So I point out to people regulations require that farmers maintain or improve the quality of their soil, and that there's entire sections underneath that on that don't specify you have to do these things, but here are some ways that an organic farmer must, that's the language, reduce soil erosion or prevent soil erosion. And then mentions cover cropping and crop rotations. So all of these things that people now think of as regenerative are in there already. And then the other thing I hear often is, resistance to kind of the standardization of organic, that people say, oh, well, it's a checklist, and regenerative is about the context of each farm and understanding that each farm is different and has different ways to get to a regenerative state. And so then I point out that, well, organic is not a checklist either. It's right. Farmers have to write an organic systems plan. And that's the basis and the foundation of the inspection process.
And it's a process-based standard. So explain that. It's not, like you said, a checklist.
Right.
It's process-based. And
exactly.
I actually have really big concerns about people are saying, well, it shouldn't be process-based now mm-hmm. anymore. They're saying,
outcomes.
Let's look at results.
Yep.
Let's look at
yep.
the soil organic matter. And I'm thinking, I send the exact same soil sample off to different labs and get completely mm-hmm. different soil organic matter results yeah. back. So
yep.
talk about the, you know, whether you think it should be process-based or outcome-based and the complications with both.
Yes. So I think there's absolutely this push for outcomes-based, and to the point where some people think process doesn't matter. That is obviously, again, I studied ethics. From an ethical perspective, that's deeply problematic. Process does matter. It matters how you get to your outcome, right? Do the means justify the end? If the means are pretty terrible, they don't, right? Of course, the example that is on everybody's mind now is tillage versus herbicides. You know, if you are measuring the top layer of your soil and you got to higher soil organic matter by using lots of herbicides, does that justify, right, the outcome? When if you take a soil sample 3 years later, you might start seeing a decrease because of the toxic disturbance of the soil. So there's just so many factors.
Or at a different depth.
And that's the other thing is, right, I'm sure you've talked about this with the soil scientists you've interviewed, but the how deep you go matters. And so if you're just looking at the top layer, then yes, you might see improvements in soil organic matter in the short term from no-till. But if you go deeper, you're pretty much finding that it's been flipped around, right? So you flip the carbon to the top layer from the deeper layer. So yes, it matters how you measure. And it goes back to the mindset and kind of the way we think, right? Like, can you understand all of the unintended consequences? So if you're measuring one thing, you're laser focused on carbon. And that's another thing I want to talk about is this like laser focus people have now on carbon. But if that's your focus and you're saying, okay, that's what we're going to measure, how are you measuring herbicide contamination of rainwater, which we know is happening, right? Like, and so, just making sure that you're...
Fertilizer runoff,
exactly.
Yeah.
So are you measuring everything you need to be measuring?
Worker exposure,
exactly.
You know, even the human side of it.
Yep.
Yeah. So much to unpack there. First, you mentioned if you're going herbicides versus,
tillage.
Tillage, thank you.
Yep.
Explain, people who don't know farming, why mm-hmm. that's even a choice.
Yes. So farmers have to do something. They have to manage their land for things like weed control, and building fertility of the soil. So there are some people who really strongly believe now that tillage is bad. Tillage disrupts the soil biology, the living ecosystem in the soil. You're essentially, by putting a plow through it, you are You know, it's like weed whacking a forest, right? Like you're really destroying the living organisms in the communities. But farmers have to, if they're not tilling, then they have to do something for weed control or just managing their land. So herbicides then becomes the go-to alternative for no-till farmers, where in order to not till, they'll just terminate their cover crops. So cover crops, you know, need to be terminated, need to be
make space for
replaced with the actual cash crop. And so then if you're not tilling, doing that mechanical disturbance, then the alternative is chemical disturbance. So they're both forms of disturbance. It's just one is mechanical, the other one is chemical. So it's like, yeah, what's pick your lesser of two evils. And I think in organic, there is no question what the lesser of the two evils is. And in fact, some people say, well, it actually tillage is not, you know, tillage done right with intention is actually not that harmful. Again, if you look at outcomes.
What is right with intention? Incorporating a lot of biomass.
Exactly. Like if you're tilling just because you feel like you want to do another tillage pass just to get a super clean, you know, then that's probably not a good thing. But if you're tilling in order to, say, your cover crop, you know, incorporating that cover crop, meaning you're taking a lot of green carbon-based biomass and you're incorporating it into the soil where it then becomes available for the soil biology. So that would be tillage with intention. You know, you're really doing it with the intention of feeding the soil. You're feeding the soil. Doing it with tillage is one of your tools. Versus the other approach, often with no-till in an industrial system, is in order to store the carbon. They're not necessarily wanting to use the carbon and cycle it. It's all about, let's get it down there and keep it there. And then using that, I mean, using herbicides to do that.
And it's still so new too. I mean, I think the people who have been tilling under cover crops, incorporating a lot of biomass, have been doing this for decades as organic farmers and have seen a maintenance of soil organic matter. And of course they have long rotation. So sometimes it goes down and, you know, it comes back up again over time. And so that's what I'm worried about with the carbon dollars going to this kind of new thing that farmers are doing now, no-till. They're seeing some things are happening in the soil. It's getting a little bit more acidic. Where there's drain tiles in, the fertilizers are just applied on the surface because it's not inorganic. The fertilizers are going right through the cracks in the soil because it didn't till, right straight down to the drain tiles, and they've never seen the fertility kind of algal blooms that are happening in the waterways as bad as they are now with so much no-till taking off. So it's kind of like we don't know yet whether this is good or bad.
And I've heard that the compaction just of the soil is also becoming an issue. And I think, but the flip side is with organic, we know that it's possible to, for these farmers who've been doing tillage with intention of feeding the soil for decades, like you said, the science backs that up. They're increasing their soil organic matter. They're increasing the whole ecosystem, not just the soil, the whole ecosystem around the farm. So this idea that tillage is the one practice that's the worst practice you could do. I mean, let's think about where that came from for a second. Like, to attach the word regenerative now to the one thing an organic farmer will never walk away from. I mean, is that coincidence? I don't know, but it's striking, isn't it? That's now the one thing people are so focused on.
Are you implying it's an intentional co-option from chemical agriculture to claim this word? We talked earlier and you were saying, well, what does regenerative even mean? You gave several different definitions of it. What are ways you're hearing this word used? Because, you know, some farmers are using it truly to mean beyond organic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've noticed kind of three or let's say four schools of thought. And I'm looking at it specifically in how people think of regenerative as it relates to organic. And that's where I'm seeing kind of four approaches. The first is organic plus. It's organic as the baseline, but the standards don't really capture that beyond, you know, the truly organic, real organic, whatever you want to call it, organic that is truly like meeting the principles of organic. So that's one approach, is that people are calling that regenerative. But the baseline is organic. You have to be organic first. The second is essentially organic is regenerative, and regenerative is organic. They're one and the same, two words to describe the same concept. The third is the iFoam 3.0 version, where iFoam, for listeners who don't know what iFoam is, it's the International Federation of Organic Agriculture Movements. So it's kind of the umbrella organization for the global organic movement. So they wrote a report in, I think it was 2016, iFoam 3.0. It's kind of the next phase of the organic movement. And they called on the organic community to move beyond standardization. They called that organic 2.0. That was an important phase of the movement to get standards in place. But now we're at organic 3.0, which is meant to be more inclusive. It's less focused on certification and standards and more on let's reach more farmers, regardless of whether they're certified or not, and regardless of where they are on that journey. If they're organic in spirit and in principle, but they're not certified, they're still organic. If they're somewhere on the journey to get to organic, let's get them there. So it's the kind of inclusive, non-standardized version. So that's quite common.
So it's more of an educational movement to kind of just let everybody know who's farming, this is what organic is, you know, here's how you can become certified if you want, but here are the practices you can use even if you're not certified.
Right. And also less attached to the word organic. And so let's welcome all farmers on that journey. And if a farmer objects to the word organic because they have associations with it, it has a certain connotation, let's not let that get in the way. If they're like, I will never be certified organic for whatever reason, let's still get them on that journey. And that's why having a new word was appealing, right? Like, and regenerative is that word.
Oh, so do you think, I don't know the history there. I've heard of Organic 3.0 at iFoam, but I didn't realize that the word regenerative was sort of embraced to describe that then instead.
So not necessarily by iFoam 3.0, but some of the people who were involved with writing iFoam 3.0 who were at iFoam at the time have started Regeneration International.
Okay.
So they started a new nonprofit, a new word, regeneration, called it regenerative agriculture.
And what year was this?
So they started 2015, and then but they became so Regeneration International got its nonprofit status in 2017.
Okay, so that's fascinating. It's kind of late in the game, you know. The word kind of disappeared after Rodale was using it for a little while in the 80s. Do you kind of want to describe your thoughts on why it kind of got a revival?
Yeah. So the word regenerative goes back to Rodale in the 1980s, early 1980s. Rodale used it to describe the ideal organic system is regenerative, meaning it doesn't just sustain the farming ecosystem. It can take something that's degraded and regenerate it, or it really centers on life and regeneration. And so it doesn't just sustain, it actually improves over time using life regeneration. So Rodale used it interchangeably with organic. And
why do you think Rodale even came up with a new term? Because they were very much organic.
That's a good question. Actually, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in the same way that we, just to make things interesting when we talk, think of other words to describe what we're talking about.
So it wasn't meant as a replacement. It was kind of meant to describe, here are organic principles on degraded land that we can use to improve it and regenerate it.
Yeah. I mean, that's my understanding of it. I don't want to speak for Rodale.
Sure.
So, but that's my understanding, is that it was kind of an adjective to describe organic.
Okay.
And then the term pretty much disappeared in the 90s and early 2000s. So people have done a scientific literature review that was published a couple of years ago where they looked at the word regenerative in both the academic literature and the non-academic, so newspapers and books. And they noted kind of what we know is the term disappeared, wasn't used. And I think that it was because the movement, the social movement called organic, was focused on organic. Like, that's when the standards were being written, people were trying to build this organic industry. And so you have to pick a word, and they picked organic, and really focused on that, and didn't really talk about regenerative. And it's also a very hard word to pronounce. So, yeah, and then it came back. So the study noted 2016 as the turning point. That's when they start seeing in the academic literature that there's a clear turning point, that it starts to go up. When I did a search in the scientific literature, 2019 is the turning point.
Okay.
Where in the scientific literature, it goes from like 5 or 7 search results per year in the mid-2010s to in 2019, it goes up to like 40 suddenly. But compare that to organic. In organic, you have 700, 800 every year. Mm-hmm. So again, I think the resurgence can probably be attributed to the Rodale Institute again. So they wrote a report in 2014 and called it Regenerative Organic Agriculture and Climate Change. Okay. And they, so that's where the word comes back. Then there's the iPhone 3.0, Regeneration International. People start using regenerative again to talk about organic agriculture. And then, so after 2017, that's where you see some nonprofits starting to, that have been dealing with sustainable agriculture on their websites. 2018, 2019, that's where they switched to regenerative. And the word really takes off.
So do you think it's related to the fact that the organic standards were suffering and weren't as regenerative or as real organic or whatever we want to call it, that they should have been? Or do you think it's because... actually, I'm not going to ask that question. We have to edit it out because it didn't make any sense. Somehow we have at this, when did the word regenerative become affiliated with no-till and chemical use? That other definition, was it around the same time? So I was wondering if Rodale maybe brought it back because it was, the word regenerative was being used in a way that they weren't comfortable with. And so they were trying to say, actually, this is an organic term. Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I think the word really just from what I've seen in going back kind of historical records and even in the scientific literature, looking at websites and when they made the change, I don't think people were using the word regenerative until a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things that the Rodale Institute paper did was bring attention to conservation tillage, and that as one practice among many to really focus on soil health and carbon sequestration. And I think that that's where people then started making that connection. Oh, you know, tillage, soil, and became interested in soil. And then started attaching the word to their version of a kind of agriculture that focuses on soil. Right. And then it was no longer in the context of organic. People just started attaching the word regenerative to their version of what they would have previously called sustainable or, right? Yeah. It's just, oh, that's a good word. Let's use it.
So why, this might sound so in the weeds to people who aren't in this, why do we care so much? As long as people know what we're talking about, whether we're using sustainable, organic, regenerative, why does this matter? Why are we so interested in this evolution?
Yes, because it's once again being watered down. It's a word that has real meaning, and that's important. And we need to shift agriculture to a truly holistic, truly organic, truly regenerative system. And if once again a word is being used in a way that essentially applies the industrial reductionist mindset and applies the word regenerative, that's not good. Like, we really need to see truly a transformation at the farm landscape level. And so, you know, it's good that more people are becoming aware of soil health. And if the word regenerative helps them become more interested in soil health, then that's good. That's absolutely good. But the version that we're now seeing, the version of agriculture that we're now seeing called regenerative, which is no-till, and then maybe throw in a cover crop and call yourself regenerative, that's not the right approach. That's right. That's not what we want to see.
Thank you for listening to the Real Organic Podcast. We hope you will subscribe and share the link with your friends. And please, please leave us a rating. It really makes a difference in spreading the word about these podcasts. We hope that you will join us next week when we get to hear Hugh Kent, the organic blueberry farmer from Florida, whom you've perhaps read about in our letters, give a talk at EcoFarm last January. And Hugh is a powerful speaker talking about the challenges that his farm faces because of the USDA's embrace of hydroponic berries as organic. Hugh's story is personal, but it is also a story about so many of us and about the food that we're being presented as organic in the stores. So join us next week to hear Hugh Kent. Also, you can learn more about us at realorganicproject.org. Thank you.